Do you find it harder than ever to keep your customer training material up to date? If so, you are not alone. That's exactly why LearnWorlds has become such a standout in customer education. It gives you the flexibility to build training that feels like your brand, not like a boxed-in LMS template. And honestly, the analytics are some of the best I've ever seen. You get real insight into engagement, progress, and ROI without having to become a full-time data analyst. You can also chat with AI to immediately discover anything you want to know about your learner's progress, course trends, or revenue insights. Just ask it questions and let it pull that data for you. The integrations are smooth, especially if you're running HubSpot or automations across your stack. And the platform is actually enjoyable to use for both admins and learners, which I know sounds wild for an LMS. But here's the thing I appreciate the most. Customer education teams consistently tell us that LearnWorlds helps them move faster without relinquishing control. It is learning that scales alongside your product and business. And if you need to even train employees or partners, you can do it within the same account. Just create a new school and you are good to go. The platform is very user-friendly, so you are not relying on devs for changes that you might need to make, which gives you so much autonomy and flexibility. So if you're ready to upgrade your academy experience or rethink how you deliver product education, check out learnworlds.com today. And enter the code CELAB15 for 15% off the first 6 months of your subscription.
Welcome to CLAB, the Customer Education Lab, where we explore how to build customer education programs, experiment with new approaches, and take the myths and bad advice that stops growth dead in its tracks and put them up in like a big wad of paper and then Kobe into the trash can. I'm Adam Evermescu.
And I'm Dave Dennington. Hey, we're here together. Adam, we're here together. It's been such a long time. I'm excited.
I know. With the time zone thing that we've had over the past few years, it's been harder and harder to record together. But that just means that we have to treasure the time that we're given. And especially at the holidays, I think it's always a good time to step back and appreciate what you have and to treasure the time that you are given.
Oh, that's so holiday spirit-esque. I love it. And it reminds me of the day of the year.
I'm filled with joy and appreciation. Oh, you're reminded of a day of the year? Why? Because we're recording the intro to this show?
Yeah. You know, with this one, with this episode, I say with the spirit of the holidays upon us, I'm going with it's National Cookie Exchange Day. What better for those of us in different countries? What's the cookie of the Netherlands that you would offer up? Oh, have a nice chocolate. No, I like the peanut butter, kiss ones. You know those cookies. Mm.
Yeah, the peanut butter cookies with like the Hershey's kiss in the middle.
Peanut butter drops.
That's what you're gonna give to me. So what am I gonna exchange to you? I'm gonna exchange you. I guess like a stroop waffle or something like that. No. Here's what I'm gonna give you. No, it's not a waffle cookie. I was thinking of what's Dutch, but actually in the Netherlands, like in Amsterdam, we have a place that does amazing cookies. And anytime you walk by there, you'll see a line. This place does exactly one type of cookie. It's a chocolate cookie. In fact, the word cookie comes from Dutch. Did you know this?
Really?
Yeah. Like if you talk to a British person and you're like, can I offer you a cookie? They're going to be like, oh, is that how you talk in the colonies? Do you mean a biscuit, right? They say biscuit. We say cookie, and we say cookie because we Americans, at least I'm Canadian. I don't know why I'm saying we North American English speakers have the Dutch on our side of the world. And their word for that is koekje, which is a cookie.
Well, that's a cool story.
I'm going to give you a chocolate cookie from that place in Amsterdam that serves only one type of cookie, but it's a delicious cookie. And you know what? Because this is the dream restaurant, I have skipped the line for you. You don't have to wait in line all day. You're getting a delicious box of chocolate cookies from Amsterdam, freshly baked for National Cookie Exchange Day.
I'm going to eat them all, and then I'll go to my doctor, and he'll say, quit eating so many cookies. Yeah. All right.
Sorry, Dave's doctor. Sorry.
All right. So let's frame up this one. We're going to do a fun episode to close out the year. And Adam, we've gone back and forth on this because we're like, what are we going to do? What are we going to do this year? We always do something different. We always talk about non-customer education stuff. And I liked your idea where you said, okay, well, let's think about the things that we do. You know, music is one of the things we love. I also love video games. So we both selected a group of three things that we like in that field. You did music, I did video games. And we're going to break them down and help share how music, how games teaches customer education or inspire it, I'd say.
Exactly. We'll take some lessons learned from things we like this year. And so why don't we go back and forth? Dave, do you want to kick us off? Because you did video games, right? So
yeah.
How are you going to structure this?
Well, I'm going to structure this. And with this, I'll actually share a link I will expose my Steam replay for 2025, which is the games that I invested time in. And for this, the approach that I've taken is I've picked three games. I'll mention a couple of those. I picked three games and then we're gonna go back and forth. I'll pick one and I'm gonna start off with onboarding. And the game that I picked to represent what we can learn about onboarding, and that game is this year Helldivers 2. The award goes to them. Have you checked this game out? Have you heard this game yet? I mean,
I've heard the name of this game, but I've never played it.
Okay. Well, one of the things that I really like about video games, and I don't think you hear enough, is that if, for me, you know, I go back and I think about what we wrote up in the customer education manifesto, right? All of the premises on that are about kind of being present and learning from the environment. And we really aspire to have an experience where you can think about regular software onboarding. What does that look like? In a video game, they do onboarding very differently. Onboarding goes beyond, okay, I installed it and I'm working on it. But the game has to teach you the elements of the game without me going like back in the day where you'd get a little booklet with your game.
Yeah.
You go, okay.
This is like scaffolding, right? Like the game teaching you to play itself.
Yeah. I mean, you've done game design, so you know this. But I think that kind of a scaffolding is really well done in this game. So Helldivers 2 is a sequel. Helldivers was kind of like a top-down, not quite isometric game where you had squads and the scenario is, think Starship Troopers, right? The whole Heinlein story where you've got this invading set of bugs or whatever, and you need to take it out. What's interesting in this game is that it throws you into a scenario. And what's funny about it is I like, if you do some research on it, they talk about this ludo narrative harmony. Like
I've heard of ludo narrative dissonance. What is ludo narrative harmony?
Well, it's the obverse of that. So now they're bringing kind of this snark, right? This satirical kind of play around. You're going through a boot camp and you're thrown down in this area and you have to pick up a gun and you have to shoot a thing. And you've seen this in a lot of different games, but what was really compelling for that onboarding or for that, you know, startup scene is you go, oh, okay, I understand this. And it doesn't let you move on until you understand the basic motions. Like, okay, how do you really dive? You know, Helldivers, the namesake comes from one of the actions you can take, and you're, you know, just jumping. Well, that kind of helps protect you in certain situations. Or there's this whole thing of what's called a stratagem. And a stratagem, the scenario of the game is you come down, literally dive down onto a planet, right? And you come with a squad of 1 to 4 people. And then you have to gear up and do all this stuff. Well, you have a spaceship that's sitting over the game theater that rains all kind of hate down on the world, like laser beams. And so you have to understand how to do that. And the first time you do it, you get this little ball and like, what's this? You drop it in front of you and you're dead because friendly fire isn't. but I just loved how you're walking around your learning environment. Some of the fun things, one of the things they said is it's muscle memory over menus. That is like a key trope in the game itself. It's like, you've got to remember these actions because you don't have time to think, right? Mm. And that's one of the things that compares to me in regular training for software, we're kind of trying to affect that, where you have enough up here to understand how a software works, generally speaking, right? And then the other thing that I really love about how their approach to onboarding happened is that there's a sense of mission flow. So you do this thing, and then you're doing these actions, then you should be looking here and thinking about these things, and then you ultimately have to end the scenario, which is an extraction where you get in a ship and you take off, right? But all of these things, like grouping and laddering up or scaffolding this experience, requires you to understand what is the outcome, right? So there's, I learned the environment, I learned about the twitch, muscle mechanics, memory, and then I have this sense of, oh, now I understand the mission flow, all in kind of one fell swoop, and then I can launch into the game and I somewhat understand what I'm doing, and now it's time for learning nuances, right?
So yeah, well, it's interesting, right? Because I guess from like, if you think of it as like an instructional, like an instructional paradigm, I don't know what word to use here. Like, there are so many different ways to teach you how to build muscle memory, right? Like, you can execute the same thing over and over through menus until you know exactly like where to click everywhere. Like, I think we've all played games that have like a ton of complex menus where at a certain point you develop like muscle memory for how to navigate through the menus to get what you want. Like, a lot of like Final Fantasy games are like that. You can also have a lot of games where they drop you directly into the action, and it's really like through like repeated failure that you sort of eventually figure out what's going on. Like, a lot of roguelike games are like that. Like, I think I've talked about Hades before.
I was playing Hades 2 last night.
One of my favorite. Oh yeah, I'm saving it for later, but
it's a juicy game.
Believe me, the moment I get my hands on it, like, there's going to be an episode of C-Lab where I'm probably just like talking entirely about that game, and then like I say one thing about customer education.
Good. I'm looking forward to it.
let's see. Right, but like, here what you're describing is that they almost get meta up front about like telling you how they're going to instruct you to achieve that goal. And to me, what that relates to, like, when I think about it in terms of customer education, there's always this conflict between like, how much do we teach upfront, say in like a training course or an e-learning or something like that, versus how much do we do through performance support in the moment? And I think there's like something to be said about offering performance support in the moment when the user needs it, but at the same time is also, I think, helpful to know upfront what it is that you're trying to do, so you can get enough practice upfront that by the time you're dropped into the software, so to speak, and I put air quotes around dropped into for people who are listening, that you're ready to do those things like pretty quickly without like jumping around wondering like what am I supposed to be doing in here?
Right. You have a sense of the flow. You have a sense of the key actions.
Because if you don't, then like the performance support's going to come in, like the digital adoption product and the tool tips are going to kick in, and the user's going to dismiss them because they're like, I don't know what I'm supposed to be doing, so this is just a distraction. Let me just like continue like bumping into things.
Yeah, exactly. And I hate that. I like that you brought that up. You know, the tool tips or the whatever. You're playing a game you're constantly I hate those games. Well, actually, I can't say I hate those games because I do like roguelikes. That's a whole different kind of learning than what this is. This is kind of like a workflow outcomes-based learning with humor and, yeah, you're going to screw up a couple times in it, but when you come out of there, you go, okay, I got this. I don't feel like I'm going to jump into this game and feel bad about it, right? Yeah. I can't play.
Totally. Okay, cool. And by the way, I'm picturing Space Invaders. Like, I know that there's probably like a lot of really cool graphics associated with this game, and it's got a really distinct art style, but like, I just want you to know, never having seen this game, I am picturing Space Invaders.
Okay. I don't think it's quite like that trope, but it's pretty cool. You have to check it out sometime.
Okay.
Well, you want to switch over to music, your first music?
For me, you know, while you were sitting at home playing video games, I was out seeing shows. Okay, I don't know why.
I've gone to a lot of shows this year.
I know, and I also played a lot of video games. So
good.
Sorry, that was like my bad transition. For me, like 2025 was a year of going out to see live shows again after years of not really doing it. I used to do it a lot when I lived in Austin, and then I used to even play in a band and go touring and things like that. And then at a certain point, like especially when I moved to San Francisco and when I started working at Optimizely and then Checker and Slack, like I kind of fell out of touch with it. I stopped going to so many live shows. And then when I moved to Amsterdam, I guess it like shook something out of me when I was like, oh, like this is a part of my life I at least want to get back into. So yeah, for the past few years, I've been going out to see more shows, and 2025 was like a really cool year for that. So for my things that I'm going to talk about in this episode, like I'm going to talk about shows that I saw and what I learned from them. So I actually want to start by doing a little bit of a compare and contrast because I saw a few shows this year that were related. We've talked about Lewis Cole and his other band Knower on the podcast before. We even did like a custom clown core intro with you blasting on the sax. I listened to that episode a few weeks ago in preparation for this one. It was a fun one.
Yeah.
And I got to see both bands, actually, Lewis Cole and Knower, play live this year, which is really cool.
In Amsterdam?
I saw Knower in Dublin, and I saw Lewis Cole in Amsterdam.
That's amazing. Well, I'm glad that they're getting all over the world. They're good.
Yeah, I think they like playing Europe because there's still like appetite for people to pay to go to like jazz, funk, electronic shows here. So sometimes I think they're like, these guys are touring Europe more than they're even touring the U.S.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I'm not going to talk about Knower. It was a good show, but I don't have a whole lot to say about it. I'm going to talk about Lewis Cole.
Good.
And I'm going to contrast him specifically to another show that I saw this year, which was King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard, who's like an Australian multi-genre psych rock band. And like they release 5 albums a year and they do a lot of like jam band stuff. And every album they do has a completely different gimmick. Like, sometimes it might be that they're doing all the songs with like microtonal instruments. So like they're playing a bunch of stuff that are like between the standard notes and the scale, or they might do an album that's meant to be played on an infinite loop. So all the songs blend into each other, including the last song blends into the first song. I'm trying to remember some other ones. They did one where like each song represents one of the different modes of the scale, but also like represents a different like element and nature. I don't know. Just like a bunch of like super conceptual stuff, but the music is also good, I promise.
This was King Gizzard?
This is King Gizzard. And so this year, both of these bands, Lewis Cole and King Gizzard, did something that was very similar to each other. Like, despite being very different artists, they converged somehow, where they both decided that this year their thing was that they were going to release these orchestral albums, like their music, but backed with an orchestra and heavily arranged, super cool stuff. And I liked both albums. Lewis Cole's album is called Nothing, and King Gizzard's album this year is called Phantom Island. They're both like super well orchestrated. I prefer the Lewis Cole one more, but they're both good albums. They're both good listens, and I recommend both of them, like, very much still, like, in the style of those respective artists, just, like, with orchestra on the back.
Right.
And so they both toured with orchestras, which was super cool. So I got to see both of these like, rock bands with orchestral backgrounds in the same year. And what was interesting is, like, one thing that really struck me is that the venue matters a lot. Even though the albums themselves are like really well thought through and well orchestrated, the experience of seeing them live in completely different venues really changed the show for me. Because King Gizzard, I saw in this like very large venue, like very open. I mean, like big sound system and all of that, but like, the acoustics in there weren't that good. So I was like kind of like struggling to even like get in front of the speakers and be able to hear everything that was going on. And you could like hear the band, but you could also like barely hear the orchestra. And also because it was such a big venue, you had people like talking and, you know, kind of hanging out and all that kind of stuff. So it was like a little bit hard to focus and to really hear everything that was going on in the show. Now, Lewis Cole, on the other hand, He played in what's called the Concertgebouw, which is like the music hall of Amsterdam, mm-hmm. like where they would actually play like orchestral music. And you could tell actually, like, for them, playing in this venue was like a huge moment for them, because I don't think they had played in a venue like this before. Super old school, super optimized for classical music, and therefore, oh, and like it's like seated, right? Like people are sitting down, so it's like a little bit more like mm-hmm. respectful, and like people aren't talking and stuff like that. Like you could feel the reverence. There were a lot of moments in the show where things got super quiet and super intimate, and you could hear all the parts that like the singers were singing in multi-part harmonies, or you know, someone playing like a solo in the orchestra. And you could really feel this like deep appreciation for the composition and the orchestration and all of that. And like, it's not like that album itself is like way better orchestrated than the other one. It's like the venue matters.
Yeah. Mm. I see where you're going.
Yeah. And the other thing that I think mattered was that Lewis Cole has been working up this act at this point for years with like the same cast of characters, the same singers, the same orchestra, the same conductor. Whereas I think, don't quote me on this, like I think King Gizzard was using different local orchestras and kind of like giving them the sheet music and going with it. So for me, there's like kind of two things I take from this that are at least like tangentially related to customer education. One is that like when you think about like we spend so much time creating content. And you can think of the content here as like the orchestration and the arrangement.
Mm-hmm.
And while the actual content matters, I think the experience and the context in which you're consuming it matter more. So for us, that would be like the expectations we set, like when we make it available to the learner. Can the learner pay attention to it? Like, can they focus on it? Or are we catching them when they're like busy with other stuff? That stuff matters.
Right.
And the other thing that I think I would take out of this is like the fact that they'd worked that show up with the same cast of characters, like to feel that reverence in such a cool, like a concert hall. I think there's something to be said about like you practice with the right people for long enough and you get really good at what you're doing.
Yeah.
So I think there's like something to be said about building, you know, a highly effective customer education team.
Yeah.
Knowing what you're doing, like working with people you trust, that means you're able to work quicker and you're able to get things done, you know, in a more effective way. So, like, those are my two takeaways from that show.
Kind of like a band in that we are working together to produce content that is an orchestration. See what I did there? Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think these artists in particular, and I haven't experienced King Gizzard. I'm going to be going to do that.
Oh man, Cole, you are ready for the biggest rabbit hole in the world. It's going to be amazing.
I'm ready to go. I need some new music.
These two bands like got me through the past 3 years, them plus another one I'm going to talk about later.
Cool. Oh, yeah. Okay. This is good. I think there's definitely key things to learn because, you know, obliquely we're talking video games and music and we're trying to compare contrast, but there are things that we can learn that these are experiential things. This is, you know, set and setting, environment, thing, you know, how do you decrease noise? How do you, if you are like in the performance setting, I think that's really important too, because like we don't often think about that now that we've been removed or abstracted away into the virtual space and we're trying to train people, right? But even that orchestration, what does the virtual instructor-led experience look like? What kind of a platform are you using to affect it?
Cool. Yeah, you have to work harder in some cases because like it's not like we're bringing in people live for, you know, 3 days on site where they don't have other work going on.
That's right. All right, let's jump back to, okay, we'll go back to games. So this
back to
is
games.
My second game. And I'll put links up here and show this. The second game that I thought was really interesting and there are takeaways for customer education out of it is a game called Peak, P-E-A-K, like mountain. Have you heard of this one? Have you seen it?
No, is this like Celeste or what?
No, this is and again, there's kind of a theme here. This is a kind of a community game. You have to play with other people or you can play it alone, but it is not interesting or fun. The idea is this: is very heavily cartoony. You start off in an airport, and there's a lobby, and your friends get together. So I've been actually playing a lot with my kids on this game. At first, it was bad, and then it was really good, and that's the learning that I want to talk about here. So the principle behind Peak is you have to get to the top of the peak, right? You have to climb a mountain. So your little silly character, you go in this airport, the airplane crashes on a remote island, and it's broken in half, and you see all this gear sitting there. And you go, what in the heck? There's no guide. There's no anything. But you do find a guide on the ground, and you can, a guidebook, and you can look at it, and then it tells you about the controls and the things that you're doing. But it's not really that. There's not that much you can learn from what the system is telling you about playing the game. You have to learn through other people. And this is what I like about it. I like a lot. So imagine you're walking along and you're going over rocks and stuff, and you see the mountain and you go, okay, well, how am I going to get up that? So basically you hold the mouse or the controller and you can grab on and kind of work your way up the mountain, but it only works so far. Sometimes there's rain. Sometimes there's things that are trying to get you. Sometimes you slip because you only have so much energy. Sometimes you land on a plant that's poisonous and now you don't have enough energy to climb. So one of the things that you find is that, okay, if you're too far away from someone, you can't even physically hear them anymore, and you get distance separating you. But if you don't stay together, then the game breaks down. Because, okay, imagine you and I are trying to climb up a mountain. You're running low on energy. I just got up over a ledge. Well, I can literally extend my hand down to you, and you can grab it, and I can pull you up, right? But these things aren't very clear when you first start playing the game, and they only happen, they emerge as you're starting to play. Or maybe you have a rope, or maybe you have a piton, or maybe you have this little launcher thing where you can shoot a rope across a chasm and then you can all go over it.
So this is like emergent gameplay where you sort of have to like explore to figure out what you even can do.
Yeah. And there's things and tools that keep appearing. You're like, what does this thing do? And the first time you do it, then it blows up and you fall off the mountain or something. Like, oh, well, that was dumb. Or, you know, you have a drink and there's like an energy drink sitting here. Like, what does that do? Gives you a quick boost, but then you lose energy so fast afterwards and it has a negative effect. So I love that kind of teaching in the moment. And then I call this community-based learning, because if it wasn't for, you know, my son goes off in one direction, he goes to that. He says, Dad, come here, do this. Follow me and do this thing. And then I'd watch him and then I'd do that. I'd go, oh, that's cool. Now I learned how to do that. And then I'd play it with my daughter was there and she's trying to do something too. And I'd bring her up. So we're all kind of teaching each other and moving each other through that learning experience. That's what I like about that. The fact that now we're broaching the subject of community and bringing that learning from each other to make a better experience overall where we successfully get up the mountain. It's kind of cool.
Yeah. I mean, when you bring people together with different points of view, when you bring together a learning community or a community of practice or something like that, like it's surprising, even though it's like perfectly obvious that this should happen, that people come with different points of view and approach problems in different ways than the ones that you would think of. And bringing people together, you solve problems in better ways than you would if you just kept thinking about it with like what you yourself would call common sense.
Yeah.
Now, Dave, I'm sure that this video game has like a very distinct, unique art style and a very, very good sense of pace and character. And you said it's cartoony, but I want you to know that I am picturing Celeste.
Okay, that's fair. I have Celeste downloaded on my list to start playing over the holidays too.
Got to do it. That's a great one.
Do you ever feel like your product team ships faster than you can build training? Yeah, me too. And that's why I've been checking out what the folks at Learn Experts are doing. Their AI platform called Leia takes your existing content, docs, slides, wikis, recordings, and turns it into full training programs, publishing in multiple modalities to nail blended learning for your customers 85% faster than traditional methods. And get this, when your product updates, Leia can update the content faster by automatically incorporating it into your existing outline, content, and even your end-of-course test or exams. LearnExpert shares that their customers are reporting 90% efficiency here. Now that's time back to actually focus on strategy, or let's be honest, to finally take a lunch break. Plus, it connects with platforms like Skillshare and others so that you can publish straight to your academy without missing a beat. Check it out at learnexperts.ai/CELab and see how you can keep your learning and test in release mode. Learn Experts, build like an expert, update like a pro.
All right, go back to music. It's your turn.
All right.
What's the next?
The third band that got me through the past few years is a band called Black Country New Road.
Mm.
That's one title. And this band is, I think it's for the youngs. I think a lot of young people like this band, but you know, I try to be hip. I try to listen to like the new music that people are into. And they're still very much like in the vein of all of the like sort of orchestral indie music that I've listened to for a lot of my life. They started as this like post-rock kind of band. Hmm. And we're doing a lot of like kind of darker, sometimes like a little bit more like moody ambient kind of music. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But over time, like started to inject a little bit more of that, what would we call it? Like kind of like Arcade Fire Theater Kid energy into their music.
Yeah.
And they released this album a few years ago that like I got super into. It was called Ants From Up There. And it was an amazing album. It was super well reviewed. And like right after it got released, their lead singer left the band.
Oh.
And so these guys are screwed, right? Because like also this lead singer, he's writing these like really unique lyrics with like a really interesting point of view. He's like speak singing all of it. They can't just recreate it. So this band, they have to figure out what to do without him in the band. And they could have just stopped, but they didn't, because this band is all formed of like super talented multi-instrumentalists. And like, you know, each of them plays like three different instruments. And as it turns out, their original lead singer leaves the band. And then like three women in the band who are also like talented multi-instrumentalists step up and they say, hey, we can sing too. So now we're mm-hmm. going to be the singers of the band.
Cool.
And
rolling with it.
I know. And they released a new album this year with like them as the singers. It's amazing. I think it's just as good as the album with their old lead singer. And I saw them play, and it's one of those shows where just like watching how they're interacting with each other, like watching how they're looking at each other, taking cues from each other, it's really amazing to see. They're doing like three-part harmonies with like the three women. The highlight of the show for me was their main like pianist. Her name is May Kershaw. There was a certain point where she was like directing, like conducting the rest of the band, like with her hands, as she played accordion and piano, and everyone else in the band played recorders in multi-part harmonies. And it's like the wow. level of attunement you have to have as a band. Like they're not an orchestra. They're a band doing this. Like these guys really have to be in tune with each other.
Right.
But, and it's not super flashy. Like these guys didn't have a lot of stage banter. They didn't have a whole lot to say. They just like played through their songs, but they played through them super well. Because again, you've got a group of people who have gotten really comfortable playing with each other. They're super accomplished musicians, but they're also like very well practiced with each other. But the thing is, you can tell that this is work, because actually, if you go, for instance, on Spotify and you listen to those two albums that I just mentioned, there's actually a third album that's in the middle of those. It's a live album. Mm. It's called Live from Bush Hall. And in that album, you can hear them almost like reforming the band and figuring out what to do. It wasn't that those three women just stepped up immediately. They also had like another guy in the band who was trying to sing for a while, and then he decided he didn't want to. They were writing other types of songs that were like kind of awkward and not necessarily the sound that they wanted to hit yet, but you could hear their like commitment to carry on this project. Right. And in fact, one of their songs on that album, the lyric is like, look at what we did together, BCNR, friends forever. BCNR is Black Country New Road. And you can see this on stage. You can see that above all, they're like, yeah, they're performing for an audience, but they're also friends and they're doing it together and they're helping each other out. They're giving each other cues. So from this, like, I've learned this has been a tough year for a lot of customer education professionals. This has been a tough year for a lot of tech companies. And I think like the lesson that I take out of this is that you can persevere through setbacks when you have people you trust, when you have people that you know you can work really well with, take cues from, give cues to. It should still feel like pretty egalitarian at its best, even though there probably is a hierarchy. And that is going to come through in your performance, so to speak.
I like that. It's also that we are not, I mean, I wouldn't call what we're doing art exactly, but there is a huge creative component that you need to keep going and generating things. And you can see, I look back at my work from different places that I've, you know, been, and I could see that when we had really great teams and we were working very well together, our work product was amazing, even if it wasn't the best. And you could see how you're changing over time.
Well, I mean, to your point, like on one hand, it's not art, but we can take cues from the art world to see what people do really well. And if we just think of what we do as commerce and we don't try to get creative about it, then like we're probably going to have worse products for it. But also, like, keep in mind that it's not purely art for these folks either, right? Like in the end, a band is a business, a video game studio is a business, and like commerce also seeps its way into their decisions and the way that they can approach things as well.
With both of us having been in bands before, I definitely get that. There's a lot of work and it is not easy. And connecting with your audience, and you know, it's not the same as educating, it's entertaining. But if you're, there's that edge of interest that's always keeping people motivated to consume more, to go further. That's a good one. I'm going to have to.
That's something I'm thinking about a lot, right? Because like in all the shows that I'm talking about, I was paying a lot of attention to the way that like the bands were trying to connect with the audience or doing their stage banter or things like that. And that's what I thought was like really interesting about this one, is that they weren't talking to the audience a whole lot. They did at the end, but like they were doing their communication through the music, right? They knew what show they were putting on, and it didn't feel like rude or inauthentic.
No, that's really cool. That's an interesting dynamic. Okay.
All right. You want to take us back to the world of video games?
Yep. Got one more here. And and this one is going to be a little bit different. Before I get to the game, I want to talk about another game, which I love to hate and I hate to love, but I love it. Let's talk about mitigating retention and churn. So
my favorite
point
game.
I'm trying to make here is what can you really learn about, what can we learn from video games that informs that it's that kind of that continuous motion of learning. How do I get over some obstacles that I'm experiencing in a game that's making the experience that I'm having, whether it's on me to learn how to do something or what, palpable, like I can break it down and I can get through a crunch so that I can enjoy this game. The game I want to talk about briefly is called RimWorld. Have you ever played RimWorld or seen RimWorld?
Nope, never heard of it.
It's like a solo developer. I don't know if you saw it, but Tynan Sylvester. And RimWorld is just a brutal game. It's top down and you've got characters that land and, or you're basically trying to survive. You're trying to build a colony. You're trying to get production going, build things, survive. And I keep coming back to this. I keep wanting to learn and I keep struggling through it. The curve is just ridiculous. And there's not as much motivation within the game to go, oh, well, if you do this and this and you string these things together, then this will be easy for you. It's just a painful game to play, but it's fun. I don't know how to really explain that. It's like going to work, you know? I need to do it. The game so I really want to get
some stuff to unpack there.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack there. But RimWorld's an interesting game and it's really hard to play. And if you know how to play it well and you learn basics, it just takes a long time to onboard to that game. I keep going, well, I play it and then I don't want to play it for a long time. I play it and I'm churning. right? I turned out of the game. Yeah, there's other games that I have turned on, right? I'll try to play it and then I'm like, oh, this is terrible. And for a subscription-based economy, if you're playing an MMO or something and that game is too hard, churn is a real thing there in the gaming world too.
So yeah, totally. That's what I mean too. Like when I say like commerce is obviously a big part for these guys too. It's not like they're just trying to make art.
Yeah. I mean, you can sell a game, but if people don't play that game, then you're missing out on the long tail of the experience. And that is DLCs and expansions and the next game that you produce. And, you know, there is this educational and marketing component. The game that I've really been playing a lot of is this game that I thought at first was dumb. It's called Mega Bonk, B-O-N-K. Hmm. And the namesake of the game implies some of the actions that within the game. It looks so simple. I mean, have you played Vampire Survivors?
No.
You know, okay. It's kind of like a new category now. And there's a number of games. Risk of Rain could fall into this. But Vampire Survivors is, you basically have a character and you're just moving around. You're not doing anything in particular. Like, you're not really controlling a lot. What you're controlling is these hordes, endless hordes coming at you, right? Mega Monk is like a 3D version of that, where you have a character and you basically have attributes. You could have weapons. You have four slots for weapons. You have four slots for tomes. Tomes affect the gameplay. All of the weapons and the tomes together, there's this nuanced mechanic of how they interrelate. An example, one of the weapons is freeze. So there's a ring that appears around your body. And as you're moving through the world, anything that gets within that radius freezes and takes damage. Now I could have a tome that's affects size. So I could scale, see where I'm going, the mechanic of that radius. So it's getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And there's different dimensions of different kinds of weapons and different kinds of things coming together. What I find so exciting about this is that I'm always learning in the game itself. So I'll go, oh, well, I know how to play the core mechanics. That's easy. Run around, try to not die, attack things. And then the other thing is that you're acquiring new functions as you go and leveling those things up. So your strategy and how do you get to the end result, which is a final boss, and then you've got another level, another boss, and finally a massive boss. To get there is a game of nuanced scale mitigation. The only way I can say that is I'm trying to ratchet up all these different, like the defensive and offensive components so that I don't get crushed and I can make it to the end. But that's so hard to do. And then the game itself is teaching you in the way, like through kind of, you know, okay, I try this. Now I add this to this and now it does this. Oh, I'm going to take what I've learned and go back and play it again. And I'm ratcheting up my experience and I'm wanting to play more because I'm getting excited about new things that emerge within the game experience. And they're coming along at the right time for me and go, oh, now I can do this. Cool. And now my gameplay is more enhanced and better and more fun, right? And there's one point in the game where you get the big bonk, the big hammer thing. And when it pops, you hear this bonk and, you know, your enemies fall apart. And it's just fun as hell. So the thing about it is, for me, is that it's like the life cycle of a product where we're not actually trying to like make fun, emergent gameplay. But sometimes when you have a combination of things that you do within a platform that enhances your overall experience, I didn't know why I could do that. I remember I was working with Confluence a couple of months back and I did this and this. Oh, I know what I was doing. I was trying to write a page and I just highlighted a section of something. I thought, well, can I do this? I see this little, this AI agent. Can I highlight this section, click the button and tell it to change it? And for God's sake, it did it. And it did it really well. And it was like in that motion. And there was enough information of a tooltip in there to give me a bump to go to the next step. It's like, oh, I could do that. And then I can add this and I can go to the whole page and edit it. And now I'm getting excited about the work I'm doing because I'm finding this emergent learning happening in the flow of my work.
Yeah. So
that's where I'm going. Like, keeps me coming back to using the product.
On the game side, I had that feeling a lot when I played Breath of the Wild, right? Where it's like, you're always trying to figure out like, oh, like I shot a fire arrow at something and then it set on fire. Like, what if I can do, what else can I do that's like that? But I think even on the work side, like a lot of product-led growth products, like your Slacks, your mm-hmm. Figmas, your Notions. We talked to Bessie Weiss from Webflow in one of the last episodes.
Really, like, great episode, yeah.
A lot of these, especially ones that involve multiple people working together and collaborating, like, they are emergent, actually, right? Like, the way that you work in these products, like, do ultimately change and expand by the way that people are working in there and what they're trying to achieve. And actually, I think, like, with the new wave of AI products, we're going to see even more that's like that, right? Because AI is sort of inherently, well, let's say LLMs are inherently emergent. Mm-hmm. The way that you work with them, I think the way that we're going to have to be educating customers is going to start to shift for AI companies away from the traditional point and click and more like, what are you trying to achieve? How do you prompt the system to get you that? What are the types of things you might ask for? And I am excited next year to talk to more AI companies and see what they're doing in terms of their education and like how close it feels to that versus like how much of the more traditional or foundational education that they're doing.
Yeah.
I think before we move on.
Yeah.
I know that this game probably has like a really distinct art style and probably has like a very like, you know, it's almost like fun, emergent, goofy gameplay. But I want you to know that the game that I am picturing in my head is Whack-A-Mole.
It's kind of like that. it's cheap on Steam. It's fun to play. But I think you get the point here. And going back to that AI thing, I'd like to talk about this more and to our audience, you know, if you're experiencing a lot of really interesting AI tooling and things and coming up with ideas, we want to learn from you.
If you're doing customer education for an AI product as well, awesome. Like, come on the show and tell us what you're doing, because this is like
an open invite.
Even having gotten a taste of this, for instance, with like we have a Personio assistant, which is an LLM based product, right? You prompt it like, give me these insights about like how our headcount has developed over the years, or like things like that.
Right.
Well, you need to know what you're searching for before you actually work with it, and that's not always going to be so intuitive to a customer. Like, you sort of need to know like what kind of things can this assistant tell me to do? What kind of things should I be searching for? What are the guardrails? And that requires a different type of education. So I'm genuinely curious to talk to more people who are doing education for these types of products.
Yeah. I could inject a whole bunch of thoughts and things that I've experienced over the year, but you're right. We definitely want to learn more. So do we want to start wrapping up and do your last comparison?
Yeah.
Music? Let's go to that.
Okay. Back to the music world for one more go. So, again, I'm going to do a little bit of a compare and contrast, mostly because I saw a lot of good shows this year and wanted some opportunities to get a few more in here. Two shows I saw this year were St. Vincent and Tune Yards. Mm. So two aliases for two great artists. St. Vincent is Annie Clark, originally from Dallas, used to play in the Polyphonic Spree, in fact, and there's at least one other interesting fact about her that I'm forgetting at this moment, but I've seen her a few times because, again, she's from Texas, and every time I've seen her, it's a completely different show, which is cool. Like, she's always evolving as an artist. She's, like, very, almost trying to, I think in some senses, trying to be like a little bit of an evolution of like a Bowie or a Prince or someone like that,
nice.
Who like kind of has multiple eras, but is like really focused on their artistry. She's known a lot for her like insane guitar playing, but she's done albums and shows where like she hasn't played the guitar almost at all. So this tour that I saw her on recently was for her newest album. It's called All Born Screaming, which is kind of a return to her more previous arty sound, and good show in general, but like two things that really stood out to me. One is that she kept like crawling into the crowd in a really interesting way, like she like trying to like reach out and build like a physical connection with the audience, but like at the same time still kind of keeping this like aloofness to her performance. Like, So you could contrast that with her stage banter, because she was doing something with her stage banter that I've never seen any other artist do, which is she would start in this really almost like scattered way, as if she were an alien that had been beamed down onto the stage and suddenly been asked to speak to a group of humans that she has no idea how to communicate with. So it starts very scattered and slow, and then she starts to ramble and her thoughts go in one place or another. But then clearly she's got something worked out with the band already, because she'll be halfway through a sentence and then the band will start the song all at the same time. So clearly they're listening for like a cue or a code word or something. I don't know how exactly what they were doing. Like maybe she was making a hand gesture behind her back or something like that. But the fact that they all knew how to start exactly on time, like right mid-sentence, mid-word, was so unexpected and really like shook me out of my my complacency. But at the same time, it was like a really interesting contrast between her like wanting to build this like physical connection, but at the same time was like doing it in this very aloof, like almost unemotional way.
Interesting.
Yeah. Okay.
I want to inject something. So one of the shows I saw this year, and I saw a lot of them, I got to see LCD Sound System, TV on the Radio. I don't know if you follow them.
I ran into that guy once in Williamsburg.
Oh my God, it's such a great show. And then, but I'm thinking right now, you're evoking that going out in the audience, St. Paul and the Broken Bones was one where I was in, and I saw them like the last couple of years. And then all of a sudden you would be like listening, you'd be having fun, and all of a sudden there's the guy behind you and he's singing and bringing you into the show. And then he's up over here and you're like, what? And like you were saying that disruptive moment of surprise, right? It's like,
yeah.
And it made it so much more dimensional, right? It's somewhat now like you're pushing the aura and your arms are open. Now you have a connection. It's not just something you're watching. You're part of that experience, which I think is why St. Vincent and others like her like really connect, because you can see they're real, they're physical. We crave that anymore. I don't know if you're going along the lines of how would that show up in customer education?
We'll get there. I'm comparing it. Cool. I mean, like, actually, I'll compare and contrast it to something else too. Now that we're just talking about like other ways to be present with the audience. Like I saw a band this year. Like, I don't know that this is like uncommon. I just haven't seen it happen exactly this way before, where like there was another band that we saw touring, Canadian band called Fox Warren. And, they happened to be, you know, they were kind of like doing a DIY tour. They didn't have roadies or anything like that. So like they had like kind of long spells of tuning between each of their songs. Mm-hmm. And every single time the guy was like doing Q&A, he just kept asking, he's like, does anyone have any questions for the band? And then people would just like shout. Yeah. And people would just like shout out questions. They would answer questions. So it's like, there are a lot of different ways to build community, which is sort of where I'm going with this. And so like Toon Yards is the band I actually wanted to compare and contrast with, because again, you've got like another person working under an alias. Like it's sort of her band. Like at this point, Meryl Garbus is her name. She's from Oakland. So two people from two places I've lived. Yeah. And she's at this point doing a two-piece act with her and I think it's her husband. And they're doing it all with a loop pedal. So like she's standing there with like drums that she's like playing to build the beats. He's got a bass and a synth. She's got a ukulele. Like they're building everything up via loop pedals, which like are super interesting in general, seeing artists do loop pedal shows.
Isn't this something Lewis Cole does a lot?
Lewis Cole also does things with loop pedals. Yeah.
Yeah.
Not so much in this show because he had an orchestra, but he did some loop pedal stuff. But she's been doing this for years, right? And if you listen to a lot of her albums, you can kind of hear it as well, or like watch her on YouTube. But she's been doing this long enough that she's got it down to a science. She knows exactly when which element needs to get in there. She's like a crazy vocalist where she does multi-part harmonies with herself, and they're kind of built with like her coming in at different times. So she needs to know how to build these very precisely. But because of that, She also knows, even though it's this really complicated show, it means she knows also when she could like get out from behind her loops and get out in front of the audience and like dance and get the crowd excited. She also, you know, like had the crowd sing different harmonies and things like that, like Jacob Collier style almost. And what I saw here between like St. Vincent and Toon Yards is like different ways of relating to the audience, different ways of still building community, and maybe different ways of in one sense, like almost pulling you into the art or making you see the art as artifice.
Yeah.
Even though they were both sort of like attempts to reach out to the audience and pull them into some sort of community. So lessons. One, I think like thinking about even with constraints, like having to go back to your loop pedal every so many beats you know, only being able to like crawl so far into the crowd, you can still build community and you can still build community around your programs. But second is that like, you might have to go for something that has some edges. Like, don't be afraid to go for the unexpected or weird. Don't be afraid to like shock people out of their complacency a little bit to make sure that they're paying attention. Because if you only go for what's expected, it's easy to go on autopilot. It's easy to go to zone out. And that kind of brings me back to the point that I was making much earlier with King Gizzard and Lewis Cole, which is like the experience and the context matter. So the more you can like get the learner to pay attention, the better results ultimately you're going to have, whether you're doing it within the flow of work or whether you're kind of like deliberately trying to shock the learner out of the flow a little bit.
I think this is really interesting, Adam, like that the, and I particularly am thinking now back on, gosh, there's one experience that I had. I was working in Azuqua where you're talking about edges or doing something different and trying to build community. And I took a completely radically different approach to teaching, which was I was streaming on Twitch and I would, you know, I was bringing people into the act of, well, I'm going to teach you about this, but I'm actually learning in the process and I'm doing that out loud. And that experience, that edge was really successful for that moment in time, but it wasn't anything expected. It was a surprise. So, oh, I love this. And I like how you've articulated the role of community in learning, where it's in music, like if you're just watching it, you're not involved in it. But we as musicians like want to feel that, trying to evoke that sense of like, how does community play out in customer education? A little bit more different, but you can still get some of those surprises and excitement. Don't you think?
Yeah. I mean, I think what we saw with the different live acts is different ways of relating to a community and like maybe even different definitions of like who the community is and like who they're interacting with. Like BCNR were like, they knew they had the audience, but were mostly like their community was each other. Whereas like maybe a St. Vincent or a Toon Yards were like playing much more for like their community. And like, I don't know, King Gizzard was like freaking like crowd surfing. So who knows?
Oh my gosh. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, on that, we're crowd surfing out the door. Let's wrap this one up. This is a great discussion, and I think we'll have to. I don't know. We have time to record some music, our own music, but we'll probably put links in a playlist up for this episode.
Yeah. And then I already have ideas for what to do next year. Cool. Let's see. Let's just try to learn enough for this year that we get to do another fun episode next year.
Well, I'm sure we will. Okay. Well, as we always do, if you want to learn more, we have our podcast website at customer.education. For this one, I will make sure to put in some extra notes and links and things to the bands we've discussed. And if we have any other thoughts, we'll add them in there. And
don't forget to add Dave equals true at the end. Customer education Dave equals true for 30% off.
Hey, oh wow, we're selling it. Cool.
That's just a little fun for when you look at the Google Analytics, you know.
Gosh, that'll be funny. That would be funny. I'm gonna go ahead and try it. And again, I'll take a note. Keep laughing. If you are back to the comment we had about AI and such, if you'd like to be on the show or you want to talk about things you're experiencing and that you can share with the world, just reach out to either of us or click the link on our contact form on their website.
Lewis Cole, we know you're listening. Come on the show next year.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'll try to reach out. We're also part of the customer education community where you can connect with, learn from, and share your ideas with your peers, leaders, and others that are making a difference. So, you want to take the rest of it on out, Dora?
Yeah. Don't forget to reach out, find your people. What do we say?
Well, we got to thank Alan Cota for his
music. Oh, yeah. We got to thank, yes. Our original mega bonk, Alan Cota. Oh, yeah. Leave us a 5-star review. Leave it on Apple Podcasts specifically. Please tell us that we have done a good job and that we are enough. Because that's all you want at the end of the year. If you didn't like it, please give us feedback in private. But you could also leave us a review. But to our audience, sincerely, thank you for joining us. Go out and educate, experiment, and find your people. That's what we say.
Cheers, everybody. Find your people. Cheers.